This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The financial markets in this country rebounded somewhat yesterday before falling once again. The now four-day trend was brought on, in part, by turmoil in the Chinese economy.
Meanwhile, in China, the government has just cut interest rates for the fifth time since last November in an effort to stimulate economic growth. The interrelation between what's happening in Beijing and what happens in New York, Washington, or Milwaukee gets our regular conversation going with foreign policy contributor Art Sear. Hi, Art. Nice to see you.
Always nice to be here, Mitch. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
We appreciate your being with us. So we have two major issues in front of us this week. And so let's start with global markets and specifically China. What do we know about what's happening in China right now to send its finances into the slump they're in?
They've had a huge run-up in their stock market, to put it mildly, especially over the last year. They're a nation undergoing revolutionary change. Fortunately, it's in the direction of free markets and some very limited increase in representative government and some restraint on the traditional police state. So in that sense, it's a very good revolution from the American point of view. What they lack is infrastructure, and that includes human infrastructure. There are plenty of engineers and plenty of technicians, but executive talent in terms of dealing with modern, very unpredictable, and very fast-moving markets, I know is not present in the same way it is not only in the U.S., but in, for that matter, other parts of Asia and also especially Europe.
Well, and so what's the connect the dots for us? What does not having the executive power or maybe the slightly lower level executive power do in terms of causing finances to go haywire?
It makes it more difficult to manage fast-moving events. Infrastructure includes not only roads and highways and also human beings, as I've tried to indicate, but also institutions that have a long history and are very familiar with not necessarily the latest in high-tech computer technology, but are familiar with financial markets and investment and investors. London has continued to be a principal global financial center. There were lots of predictions when the euro emerged over a decade ago that some combination of Frankfurt and Zurich, Frankfurt and Paris would replace London. That hasn't happened because they have literally hundreds of years of experience with stocks, equities, bonds, insurance. They predate even the good old USA in that regard, and that's the kind of thing that I think is important and I'm trying to make clear.
So this is really the issue with an emerging capitalist state that's not all the way there.
Exactly. And for the complication, despite my optimism here, they're capitalist in economic terms, but the government is trying very hard to maintain the communist political infrastructure. So far with success, but they've got to face change. Communist bureaucrats may be durable in terms of their own political system, but they're not the best people to look to deal with financial crises.
Well, and the Chinese government has enacted some measures that we might expect any country to do in the wake of something like this. They're lowering interest rates, for example.
Yes, that's right. And they still have control over interest rates. Interest rates have been effectively at zero, as you and I and I'm sure our listeners know, for quite a long time in the U.S., and a good part of the rest of the industrial world. They have, ironically, more opportunity to try to use these classic tools to manage demand and manage activity in the financial markets than we do. But we have a much more stable environment in the West.
At the same time, the U.S. economy or the U.S. stock markets, anyhow, have been on something of a roller coaster linked to what China has been going through. You know, connect these two not-so-disparate events for us. Why is the turmoil that the Chinese economy is facing, at least from a stock market standpoint, impacting what people are doing in other parts of the world?
Well, we really do live in a global economy. It's become a cliche, but it's an accurate cliche. It's certainly not a trite term in the sense that globalization is ever-changing. We have more fluid and more plentiful capital than ever before in history. In 1973, commercial banks worldwide got together to facilitate financial transfers of funds. It quickly grew to a vehicle for enormous fund transfers, and that means money can move very, very quickly, as fast as electricity. That's been a huge change for the world. 1973 was a long time ago, but it really was a change moment when markets became global and you saw much more coordination between different regions.
And so what's the takeaway for an investor in Milwaukee or Kenosha or wherever?
Whether it's a contemporary electronic money manager type or an old-fashioned stockbroker from the 50s and 60s, they will tell you to diversify. And that's more true now than ever. It relates not only to the type of investment also, but also to the part of the world in which you're invested. There are some durable truths, which I say not just because I'm getting old and grumpy, more so all the time. There's a book called Security Analysis by Graham and Dodd, Benjamin Graham and David Dodd. Came out in 1934. It's been a steady seller ever since. You can't just listen to talk TV and radio. You can't just glance at the newspaper. You can't just listen to your friends and associates. It's a hard slog of how you analyze specific money, specific companies, excuse me, and money. And if you want to make money over the long term, it remains a great Bible for actually analyzing specific firms. There are stocks. Procter & Gamble comes to mind, not always in the headlines, that have made money for decades, in some cases in this country, well over a century. And picking individual stocks and individual investments, not necessarily stocks, is, I think, the best way to hedge against the riptides of intense emotion that always will define markets, I guess, no matter how automated they are.
Now, there's some, including most recently Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who either imply or come straight out and accuse China of actively manipulating its economy for the effect it would have overseas. Is there a grain of truth in that? And at the same time, don't all countries actively manipulate their economies in a way?
Well, naturally, I'm shocked, of course, by the governor's statement. And the short answer to your good question is yes. But the more free your economy is, the more limited the capacity of government to intervene. I've been talking about the importance of experience and expertise. We really have not had substantial nationalist protectionism since World War II, thank God. If the governor or Donald Trump becomes president, I don't think we'll return to protectionism, even though they and others have preached that. It just doesn't work in the contemporary world. It means that dramatic and arbitrary government action from the top is very, very limited. Another point to keep in mind is that governments never have completely controlled economies. With the fading of pre-war protectionism, governments are only one actor, even in dictatorships like China, partial dictatorships like Russia. The North Koreans can't completely control their market. The Vietnamese can't anymore. But who wants to live in North Korea? That's the reality that you're looking at if you try to control everything in today's very changed world. Western companies and other international companies, not basically Chinese in nature, are increasingly responsible for the tremendous longer-term growth and expansion in the Chinese economy. You're talking about companies like General Motors and Ford and Procter & Gamble and Sara Lee. All kinds of companies actually making things as well as providing services. They may be listed in the Shanghai Stock Exchange, but they'll be listed on Wall Street, obviously, as well, in London and Frankfurt. These are global companies, and while they're affected for good and ill by the developments in the Chinese economy, they're less and less under the control of Beijing, the communist government there.
Well, so then Governor Walker, in his role as presidential candidate Walker, has called for President Obama to call off a planned state visit from the Chinese premier. What is his reasoning there, and would there be any wisdom in such a move?
You'll have to ask Governor Walker the next time you interview him on your very fine Lake Effect program. All kidding aside, I see no point in reason in doing that. The Chinese government, they certainly didn't engineer this crash. They've been scrambling to try to stop it. They are in a position to manipulate their currency, as are some other countries. And they've tried to do that to gain advantage. But as the current market crash shows, that doesn't really gain you an advantage over the long term. There's also another important point here. The U.S. government has not tried to control its currency. Starting with World War II, U.S. business leaders and government leaders working closely with them worked very consciously to position us to have a strong position after the war as well as victory in that terrible struggle. We made the dollar fully convertible, in effect, into other currencies as long as they respected strict exchange rates. Other countries, especially Japan, took the reverse course, tried to tightly control their currency. And look where we are now. In the 1980s, an awful lot of people thought Japan was on top of the world and about to take over economically. Obviously, that didn't happen. The brilliance and the great strength of free trade is demonstrated by the fact that the much shrewder Americans made our currency fully convertible. We can't control it, especially since Nixon ended fixed exchange rates, but it does give us the high ground in terms of influence within the global economy. I hope that's clear, because it's an important point, and it bears directly on a lot of the most irresponsible rhetoric coming out of this political campaign, especially on the Republican side.
Well, and so this is an excellent segue, rhetoric in the presidential campaign, because there is a lot of it going on right now in relation to immigration reform and more specifically birthright citizenship. Mm-hmm. In the grand scheme of immigration and the impact it has on the U.S. economy, how big a deal is birthright citizenship?
I think it's a very – I don't think it has a major effect on the U.S. economy. I do think it has noticeable effect on a lot of American workers, and people feel that it does. Birthright citizenship is a shorthand referring also to enormous immigration into the U.S. from south of the border, a lot of it illegal. People are concerned about this. I've talked to more than one, not faculty member, but working person at Carthage College where I work, but people who are involved in more in manual labor than I am, who are very upset about this, the sense of unfairness. And I do think that the Republicans who are working this issue aggressively are on to something in terms of public sentiment.
Unfairness in terms of?
They're not playing it straight. They're not on the up and up. But their children are getting the advantages of American citizenship by not playing by the rules, by coming into the border, over the border surreptitiously, or even if you're here legally, you're just here to have the child and then leave or stay. It's working the system in an unfair way, a lot of people perceive.
You see this as a fairly significant opening for Republicans, whoever can seize the highest ground on it?
Whoever can make a sustained and basically responsible case. Collectively, ultimately, we're quite responsible, I believe, in this nation, with rare exceptions. And the way our system currently functions, the person or people with the most flash are out front soon in the 24/7 media cycle, but they often are not the most durable.
So if Donald Trump is succeeding in talking about this, questions still remain about his durability. How do the Democrats talk about this? We don't really hear a lot about where Hillary Clinton is, where Bernie Sanders is, where Martin O'Malley is, where James Webb is, where the handful of other Democrats who have either announced or are still considering announcing, Joe
right.
Biden, for example.
Exactly.
Where do they enter into the birthright citizenship debate?
Well, that's a good question. Protectionism is actually stronger in the Democratic Party today than in the Republican Party. You see that in congressional votes. You see that in the problems the president has had with free trade agreements. Bernie Sanders is an old-fashioned kind of socialist and also protectionist, an American-style socialist, if you will. That's certainly part of his platform. Others have kind of been minimizing this. Hillary Clinton has been very, very careful on the subject without being explicit. She's tried hard to distance herself from the White House on things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and these other comprehensive freer trade agreements. The populism seems to be much more on the Republican side, but the Republican Party, starting with Eisenhower, has rejected protectionism and is much more our free trade party. It's been more subdued, I think, partly because the Democrats are in White House power and people don't want to openly break with the administration. Also, it's not so far a major issue in the Democratic Party. It may, if some Republicans really continue to get traction with this. Mrs. Clinton has also been the front runner and still is, I believe, in terms of national polls. She's got some trouble in New Hampshire. And unless that situation changes radically, I think they'll continue to be collectively rather cautious on this. Bernie Sanders isn't stressing trade. He's stressing old-fashioned class warfare, as I would say if I were a Republican, but these striking differential between the rich and the rest.
Art Sear, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mitch.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and the director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's also our regular foreign policy contributor.